Hello and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, 18th of July 2025. This week it was Kane Glancy and Phil Brining in the hot seats talking about the DUA Act again. How did you think it went, Kane?
Good afternoon, Phil. I really enjoyed the session. DUA has been something that I've really found quite fascinating, and I've been enjoying getting loads of different people's takes just in general in the chat and over the past two sessions in relation to their thoughts on the actual act and as well the steps that they're taking internally. We had Carl on mute and share some stuff that he's doing internally, which I think is always good to get that other side of the curtain that we don't always necessarily see as well in terms of how they're preparing internally as proposed to us being external. So that was a really valuable insight. Other than that, it was always great to chat through the changes of the DUA. I really enjoyed our particular discussion around, of course, the Ministry of Defence breach, and a recap over some other news, because it was a very big week for news, clearly, in the data protection space.
There's quite a lot, aren't there? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. Obviously, the breach but the incident that happened at the Coldplay concert with the CEO of Astronomer, as well as a really interesting case, Phil, that you spoke about in relation to lawyers using AI and a junior barrister who's using AI for research, which didn't quite turn out the way he planned. But no, I definitely enjoyed the session.
Yeah, good. It just occurs to me, please do not take this the wrong way, and I should have probably said this in the main session, but when the GDPR came into effect, you were still at school, weren't you? So I can't imagine that you were paying much attention to it. So this is probably the first time that you've seen that process. You've seen the bill, you've seen the act, you've seen the implementation become phased, you've seen the not the panic, but people thinking, oh, how does this affect us? You're seeing the guidance, you'll see it dropped out in phases.
That's why it's been so fascinating, Phil. As I say, like when I joined the business in 2022, everything felt like obviously very still.
It was remote, it was all in place.
And there was a lot of things that personally I thought could have done with changing. Not that I wanted to change the law per se, but things that I thought deserved more guidance, further explanation, stuff along those lines. So as I say, it's been really interesting for me to see like how organizations and everybody sort of reacts to new legislation. So yes, definitely. I feel like I learn something every day. So it's definitely nice from that perspective.
We all do. Yeah, I enjoyed the chat. I think it was really good to get. There was a lot of interaction again on the chat. And that was useful. And yeah, we talked through not all of it, but some of it at a slower pace this time. You know, we talked a bit about the SARS. We talked about the data protection by design. We talked about the complaints process, we talked around, and what we didn't really talk about, which is one of the first questions, we didn't really talk much about the impact on research organizations and the kind of reuse of data. So we've taken that away as a action to go off and do some further work, and then probably have a session about that if there's enough people who want to have a session about that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we don't want to give too much away, so me and Phil will stop now, and we'll let you get right into the session. Thanks up.
Today, we said we would try and catch up again on the Data Use and Access Act. Mm-hmm. We did a session 2 weeks ago. We covered a lot of ground this week. I think we're going to try and go at a slower pace. So by all means, you know, use the chat. And if you've got things that you want to say or you disagree with, then by all means, you know, dive in, unmute and have your say.
Yes, absolutely.
But before we dive into that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had one thing that I was needing to bring up from Miles, and I thought I'll bring it up now before I forget. Okay. After the session, Miles is going to send emails around to anybody that's listened, gauging interest for a quick form about an in-person DUA event that we'd probably be looking to do in the very near future. Just around, effectively. It should only take around like 20, 30 seconds. But it'll just help us identify.
It's a very quick in-person event.
to fill the form out.
Oh, right. I get you.
To gauge interest in terms of like location as well and the topics that we need to focus on. So, you know, expect that come from Miles. It's up to you guys whether you want to complete them, but anything that you have completed would be largely helpful in helping us get an in-person event off the ground. So I'll appreciate it if any of you could do that. But I'll let you carry on, Phil. Apologies.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that I spent a lot of time yesterday. I was doing quite a lot yesterday, but in the background, I asked ChatGPT to prepare a keeling schedule for me, incorporating all the changes brought about in the DOA Act to the UK GDPR. And I have to say, it took all day because it was such a painful process. I couldn't believe how wrong it was. It's a good job that I knew enough to know that it was wrong because, for instance, it insisted on going through article by article anyway. And it got to Article 6 and it completely took out 6.1e, it's a public posting of necessary for public task, and replaced it with the recognised legitimate interest. So I said, why have you done that? And he said, oh, sorry, yeah, that's a mistake. Yeah, I was doing a broad overview rather than a detailed professional deep dive on it. But doing a professional deep dive on it.
Yeah. It's weird how it categorises that as a face level. It's made a big change in the law and just said, oh, I was just doing a little face level thing. Don't mind me, kind of
thing. And then it got through to Article 21, for instance, and it said, no changes here. Yes, there have been changes. What about Section 75? You know, so, you know, it just shows that, you know, and that brings us to one of our news articles, doesn't it, that we wanted to talk about. It just shows that, you know, you've got this superb tool, but you know, you've got to know how to use it.
It sort of cues back into a very, very, very corny line I'm going to borrow from the Spider-Man films, which is
thank you, Charlotte.
Oh, there we are. Which is that with great power comes great responsibility. We should not be overusing these things for anything that's going to fill in a blank. I don't think the effective use is to fill in a blank. I think you need to be just as sure of the content as they're providing just to be able to question and challenge it. I mean, it's a good point, Jacqueline. I don't know if it really... It can be a good tool. I mean, I am not always super optimistic about it. I try to steer away from it. There's been times where I feel like it's been beneficial to me in what I do, but in terms of the work I do with customers, I never feel like I want to touch it. It scares me a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, the reason for doing it was I wanted to see how it responded. I thought, you know, the DOA Act is so, I find it quite hard to follow the way it's been written, you know, but you know, change this in that act and change that in that regulation and change this over here. And instead of that, insert this and all that kind of stuff. So you need the base level tech to start with to apply the changes to, and it's actually quite hard to do, I found. So I did do my own keeling schedule for bits of it, thinking that I won't understand this, so I actually see it written out as the revised GDPR. So I thought, well, I'm just interested to see how good a job it does of this. It should be pretty straightforward. You know, it should be able to read these changes, apply the context to make the changes, but it was really hit and miss. So it's useful that Charles put that up. I'll have a look at that later on. I have not actually read the final output of my own efforts, but I just think it's good to look at it as the finished text rather than trying to piece it together using the DOA as it is. But that's just me. Maybe I've got
no,
the
absolutely.
Sort of brain for it.
The DOA is terribly difficult to read. I think anybody in this chat or listening who's very likely read it, it's absolutely awful. It's almost like you're playing like a connect the dots kind of game. You have to jump back to where it's saying, oh, this is where it changes this here. So you got to jump back, have a check of that. Are you jumping straight back to the DOA and then you jump to the pecker? It's a real task. It's definitely not the easiest thing to read. So I understand trying to condense
but what
it.
Amy's saying is every time it gets something wrong, I say, well, how did you get to that point?
And tell it off,
a kind of polite apology and then, oh yeah, I'm wrong, you know. and Mark's point is great. You know, is it just learning how to do our jobs, and we'll all be?
Yeah, maybe that's what we're feeding it. Or we're giving it the tools to eventually do our job. But that's the point, isn't it? AI does learn off of interactions, which I guess is what makes it inconsistent. Is that maybe it's occasionally being fed information that isn't entirely accurate, which
it is. But
does...
in the case of, sorry to cut across, but in the case of, you know, comparing two documents which are, you know, well defined, it shouldn't be that hit. Well, I don't think it should be that hit and miss, but
well, you wouldn't think so. But I've tried to do very similar things. I was trying to convert a piece of work I made internally into a blog, and it just flips it on its head entirely. It gets the structuring really wrong. It adds really weird like caveats or rules that I wouldn't have wanted it to put in. I was telling people things that I wouldn't necessarily want to tell people. Is when you give it a simple instruction as to just, you know, just tweak this format for me slightly to make it into something that's markable. It just, you know, you give it an inch and it takes a mile in sort of like, I guess, like the creative liberties as well in terms of what they're telling people. And I do hate the way it writes in general. I think you can spot an AI generated post from a mile off these days, I think.
I'm not very good at that, you know. People have said
that.
Oh,
really?
I'm not sure I can. Anyway, what's been in the news then? I mean, probably the big thing has been the MOD breach, has it?
Yes, I mean, that definitely is the thing I've seen all over LinkedIn literally the whole of the week. I mean, for good reason, you know, people clearly quite upset with the ICO and its general response to it. I'll make lack of a response is probably more of a better word. I did see recently, I don't know if it was this morning or yesterday, but they have responded explaining their approach. It was just them explaining that, oh, you know, we understand that as a lot of taxpayers' money has gone into it, but we believe we've taken the appropriate steps, and we think, oh, what can we do to make an impact? But they didn't explain what they've done to make an impact. They just said, this is what we think every time something like this happens. And it was a lot of explaining other good things they've done. But look, we fined so-and-so for this, and we did a fine for this. And it was a lot of like trying, it felt like trying to sweep something under the rug, to be honest with you. It was a very weird response. I don't know if anybody's had an opportunity to read that yet. Awfully strange.
Yeah, I saw a link to it. I saw quite a lot of angry people. Sort of
David Hendry being one of them.
potentially, but you know, but the ICO has said that they were made aware of the situation back in 2022, weren't they? After it occurred, and were advising on it, and obviously had made some assessments onto the impact and the mitigation and so on and so forth. But it's very strange, isn't it? Because the data was out there for a long time before actually somebody realised and made amends to it. But the cost to the taxpayer is astronomical. When Rachel Reeves is standing up saying, I've got a $22 billion black hole, can't tell you all about it. Well, there's a billion of it, presumably.
Yeah. Well, it's weird. I do wonder what they're going to do in order to attempt to rectify. Obviously, as you say, it's a lot of money to the taxpayer, which is why people are upset. Apart from the fact that the breach is catastrophic, like it was very bad. And yeah, I appreciate that there was a super injunction, I guess swearing them to secrecy almost, but you know, the commissioner is there to regulate, and if it's not regulating, then what is it doing? It's the important thing. I mean, I was having a look
it's got to set the scene and set the tone for the importance of this across the country. And when you got a big breach where, you know, this is life-threatening stuff as well, this isn't just like an irrelevance of a breach, this is a serious breach. And you know, have they done enough to get the message across?
Well, the response was all about, oh, we believe that the Ministry of Defence have done enough now to effectively like assist in mitigating that, but haven't really. For, well, I guess I don't know how much detail they can go into it, but that's kind of like we decided we wouldn't get involved too much, or we wouldn't make it public because we feel like they've done enough. But it shouldn't really be one rule for one and different.
They've
for
uninstalled
another.
Office.
Yeah, basically.
But it's the same with it's like similar to rerun to the Police Service Northern Ireland, isn't it? Excel sheet, emailed out, no protection. Funnily enough, I was on the phone to a former Royal Signals person this morning. I asked him about this, and he said, you know, it could be that the person's got the wrong tools for the job, maybe didn't understand the importance of the data is handling. You know, so there's probably a range of different factors of how it occurred, but the fact it did occur is like pretty staggering, actually.
I think so. No, I really do. I see a comment from Kerry, which is something that I really wanted to pick up on, because I seen this the other day on Instagram initially about the astronomer CEO Andy Bryan, who was caught in an alleged affair with I think it was his head of people at a Coldplay concert because of one of the like the little kiss cams that they do. You know, you pan around to the camera, you get a nice little view of a couple leading them to obviously try hide and look awfully embarrassed And the guy who responded, the CEO of Astronomer, had raised serious privacy concerns around the use of things like these kiss cams. He's effectively saying, you should allow me to have my affair in peace. And I don't know. I guess it does raise some element of concern. You know, are they telling people that there's going to be cameras? But would you reasonably expect that they're going to record the crowd at these kind of events? I mean, I would sure think so. If I went to a concert, especially one that's likely going to be live, it's going to be broadcasted everywhere, I think you could reasonably assume that's something that would be taking place. Or is there an expectation that there needs to be more to put that to pace? I mean, I wasn't at the concert, I don't know what was there, but it is an interesting route he's taken in terms of a rebuttal to, I guess, to his public image.
Yeah, he should have said, "Well, I wasn't there at all. No, it's deep fake, AI generated slanderous materials."
Well, I suppose it raises the question: is it an actual, like, is it a problem? Like, does that present a problem in being able to record someone who is technically in a public area? They've came to the concert. Again, do they expect it? I think that's maybe the key. I mean, I don't think there's much grounds to what he's saying. I think he's just maybe grasping at a straw to make himself look slightly redeemable. But maybe more should be done in the ways of telling people that these things should be done. I mean, I personally think it's probably fine.
Yeah, funnily enough, there's a really good article I read about on the BBC about live facial recognition, Metropolitan Police. And what they've got, why it's good, is that they've got a journalist who actually got registered with the police for the exercise. And then before she even anywhere near the signs warning her that there's live facial recognition, you know, the system's clocked her and there's officers homing in to basically make the arrest. And they, you know, they've said that there's hundreds of people being arrested. In fact, over 1,000 people being arrested through the use of live recognition cameras. And on this news story, there's a guy who is arrested on camera for breaching his sexual whereabouts order, or whatever is banning him from being in certain places. Mm. So, you know, I think it's a real tension. You know, why shouldn't we be using up-to-date technology, you know, in terms of budget cuts to the police, you know, people on the beat and that? Why shouldn't we be using technology? And if you've got, you know, the argument, I guess, is if you've got nothing to hide, then you've got nothing to worry about. But if you have got something to hide, then society wants you to be, you know, dealt with properly.
No, I think, you know, I think I agree. It's one of those things where it's an effective use of moving with the times. You know, you're going to slowly probably get left behind. And if it's going to lead to, as long as these are a proper lawful arrests and they're done with diligence and it can be proven and they can prove, the police, that the tools that they're using are good and effective, then I see no issue with it. I suppose the issue that comes with me is, again, the accuracy and the effectiveness of using them. If it's the case that they're working and, you know, that's going to help in decreasing crime, then they're perfect. You know, I don't see an issue. I think that the problem could lie in if there is underlying issues and they haven't done as much due diligence as they should, but I'm not sure in terms of how well they handle that data. Yeah. I would be very intrigued to see specifically how the systems work.
Well, that's what this article talks through. That's why it's, I think, quite interesting. You know, it talks you through, you know, step by step, you know, what is happening. The data is being collected. It's obfuscated as soon as it's not matched with the thing and then deleted. So you actually read it, and providing it's truthful, it's actually, you know, reasonably, you know, trust-inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think I would definitely
agree. Anyway, I popped a link in there for it. If anybody wants to have a read of it, it's quite interesting. There was a couple of lawyers who they got reprimanded for the use of AI, didn't they? I mean, through the high courts of junior barristers, you know, and they got costs against them for wasting court time for having fake cases.
I mean, someone was
in what they were presenting to the courts.
Sorry, Phil. I lost my train of thought for a second there.
Yeah, but no, these two lawyers. Yeah, AI fake cases.
Yes, no, that does present an issue. I think, I don't know if our judicial system necessarily should be using AI to assist in legal research. I think using it for research of any kind is tetchy at best, and I think especially from an element of the law and an initial as a research building a defense, ChatGPT from my perspective is very entitled to lean whatever way they think you want based on the tone of an answer or a question that you're asking or whatever it is you're putting in there. It's not an effective tool for research. It does it based on what it's found publicly. And of course the law is interpreted multiple ways publicly, and they could find information that's contrary or information that they've found in a random blog written by someone that maybe doesn't know what they're talking about, or LinkedIn post or whatever. And I think that does present a problem. And I think a problem across the board in the legal profession. I think maybe even as time goes on, I don't know if it's something that will even be more common, the use of AI for research.
I think so, definitely. Right. So talking of research, that links us through to the main topic. So I don't know what we wanted to get out of today's session on the Data Use and Access Act. So if anybody's got anything they want to kind of to talk through or to chat about, then whack it in the chat here. We had a session 2 weeks ago, and I think the feeling was it would be worth a part two, because we flew through it quite quickly, didn't we? We were, when we were preparing this, thought, well, I'm not sure we've got to say other than clarify a few points you made last time. For instance, timetable. We're not much clearer now on the timetable implementation. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's worth just running over the, as we see it, the main points that affect us as privacy practitioners. I mean, there's obviously a lot more in the Dual Act that doesn't affect us necessarily directly as privacy practitioners. And also, we've really focused on the things that affect your general average organization rather than law enforcement and intelligence service processing. So is that something to probably start off with? Let's run through it. That might prompt some questions. I don't know.
Yes. Let's have a little recap. We'll go through the points that we've discussed, and then we can gauge which way the chat is leading, and we can go into some elements in some more detail.
So I think the first point is that when we did this 2 weeks ago, we thought that a lot of it had come into effect, and it hasn't, right? So it's quite clear now that the timetable, there's some that is in effect now, like the SAR changes to reasonable proportionate searches. In fact, that's backdated, January 2024. But the majority of the DUA Act is meant to be brought into effect through specific orders that the Secretary of State introduces. So I think this basically the Act gives them the right to, and the framework to make the changes that's in the Act, but it's not in effect now. So they have to bring in some implementation orders to bring the bits into effect. Now, I've read quite a few blogs about this, and they're expecting a lot of the privacy stuff to come in as early as October 25. But there's no indications of what's the priority. If you look at the ICO's guidance on the site, you know, they're saying, right, we've got this out for consultation. We expect to get it in for like spring 26, or in the case of guidance on complaints for organizations, the winter of 2025/2026. So that presumably is kind of like December, Jan, Feb time. So that's when they're going to issue their guidance. There's no indication when from the ICO site when that provision will actually come into effect.
Yeah, it feels a bit like the Wild West at the moment, doesn't it? I think everybody are trying to figure out what they want to do, what really want to go down. I've had a few people reach out to me now after sort of gaining those clarifications on the timeline and being, oh, does that mean we just wait for ICO guidance? No, I wouldn't say so. They're giving you a time to prepare. That's what it's there for. Obviously, the law it's not going to change from there. It's not going to reflect differently from there. The ICO is probably just going to help you in how you implement it, and obviously answers they shouldn't guiding you through that process. But I do think it is the case that, you know, because they're effective from that date doesn't mean you have to wait till that date to get things ready. You should, and there's no harm in being prepared earlier. It's always better to prepare for these eventualities than to wait for it to just drop on November 2025 or whenever it will be.
Yeah, and some of it we know what the impact is going to be. We don't have to wait for the guidance to understand what the impact is of a new lawful basis for processing. We know fine well what that means. You know, we've got to make sure we can start that work today. You know, we can have a look through our records processing activities. We can have a look and see if we're doing anything that might be under this new lawful basis for processing. We can change our privacy information, you know, now to accommodate the right of complaint. We can build a process around that. You know, we can test it works. So when the guidance comes out, what's it going to tell us other than what we probably can put together ourselves?
Yeah, I don't think much. Nothing that's going to change the way we do things, I don't think. But I do. I mean, overall, I think that it's better to start easing in the changes now, just because I think there's some relatively bulky work in some parts. I don't think they're all going to be super bulky changes. But if you lead with the point of starting with the Roper and then working through those identified or recognized legitimate interests now, that's probably your first port of call, I would imagine. That's probably not the most taxing task, though, I wouldn't think.
Yeah. So I've put in the chat here, there's one blog, there's quite a few blogs I've read about the time frame, and the ICO's website, I'll put a link to that as well. So there's not much that affects us that comes into effect, you know, on the 19th of June, and there's not much that comes into effect a couple of months after that. Just put that link in there to the ICO's, I think that's that whole link. But then it's all up in the air. So these blogs are saying that, you know, we expect the PECA stuff to come into effect at the back end of 2025. But at the moment, that seems like pure speculation. I'm not sure how they'll prioritize it. And of course, the DOA introduces quite a lot of changes, like the new digital verification scheme. Is that going to be priority? Or will they do the low-hanging fruit first? Let's change the PECA stuff for the charities, because that's the doddle to change. You know, I don't know. It's not clear yet what's going to get introduced and when, as far as I can see. But as I said, when we read this and did this presentation a couple of weeks ago, we made the incorrect assumption that a lot of it was enforced. Now, I think what we're saying is we know the direction of travel. We don't know specifics on timetables, but there is not as much need to panic, I would have said, as maybe we thought there might have been 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, and I think there was that initial panic on some sides. Carl's got his hand up. Before I go on a tangent, I'll let Carl go ahead.
Hello. Oh, I'm disappearing off the bottom of my own screen. Where are we? There.
Hiya, Carl. Yeah. Need to sit up higher.
Yeah. I just thought this seems like a good place to leap in, because the podcast from 2 weeks ago is fresh on my mind, because I was literally running out of time listening to it before we started this week's. And I just thought, if I read out my scribbles from last week and from the last couple of weeks of reviewing DOA as my immediate to-do list, not necessarily to be done immediately, but that I'm going to lay out for myself, please critique it and tell me what assumptions I've made wrongly. There's only five items on it. The first one is update the actual organizational complaints process so that it contains a reference to the fact of branching out to data protection. That's something we do already. I work quite closely with our complaints department, but let's make it a matter of policy and record that we have a separate stream for data protection complaints. With that in mind, the data protection complaints process, now the DOA seems to me to only say that we have to respond within 30 days. It doesn't say anything about acknowledging complaints or any of that politeness that fits into some of these processes. But my suggestion for part of the process would be acknowledge within a week for a full response within 30 days.
I thought the wording was acknowledged. Am I wrong? I felt like that was the wording, that the specific phrase was acknowledged to particularly leave an element of, so you don't have to necessarily fulfill a request within 30 days, because
I guess for some
elements it's not always feasible, is it? And me and Phil was having this discussion, in that, you know, if someone's telling you that you're effect maybe doing a restricted transfer and you don't have the appropriate measures in place, you know, first and foremost I have to identify if that's the case. I need to
my present process would be that I will acknowledge a complaint within the first few days, and if the 30-day response to that acknowledged problem is there is more to investigate, then I allow myself to spill outside the 30 days, because I've dealt with the complaint. I haven't dealt with the process that was being complained about, and I separate those logically out and allow myself that headroom. I'm hoping to continue doing that. Similarly, if you're unhappy about the nature of the data protection response to complaint to the ICO. If you're unhappy with me and the way I've dealt with it, complain to my employer using the already existing complaints process. Mm. Off you go. Second point, I might have caught this wrong. This one raised an eyebrow. Am I right that the SAR extension period is now that we can extend a SAR to 2 months, not extend a SAR by 2 months?
I don't think so. Yeah,
because right, I've seen a blog online that said an effect of the DUA was you can extend a SAR to 2 months. It didn't say extend a SAR by 2 months.
Sorry to butt in. I went on a training course about DUA this week, so it's still quite fresh in my mind. And the gentleman that was running the session said it's the same as before. It's extend within another 2 months.
Splendid.
And then
I
just
like
reply
gentleman.
As soon as you can within that 2 month period, which I'm assuming we're all doing anyway.
Oh, that's terrific. So no difference
there.
Thank you for that.
No worries.
Then I acknowledge and thank that DataWise complaints processes is or has been updated. That's much appreciated.
It needs a 30-day timer put on it, Carl. But right. So it's currently not got a timer on, but one of the jobs Matthew is going to be getting on with is putting a 30-day timer and alerts on it.
And then finally, the Roper review for better utilization of legitimate interests. I'd already scheduled that for being sort of an ongoing project for this year, simply because I attended an in-person event in North Wales a couple of months ago that one of the speakers was a representative of the Information Commissioner's Office before DUA had been released, and she was expressing her surprise to the room that legitimate interest didn't get more use in a broader context.
Oh, really? I feel like it's used quite significantly and a lot, if anything.
She said when they reviewed the legislation and when they looked at how they were going to audit use of the legislation, the representation of the ICO as a collective brain was, why aren't people doing more of this?
Really?
I find that
quite odd.
It sent me away with a big smile on my face. But anyway, so thank you for the correction on a couple of those points. I'm going to shut up again, though.
No, that's great. Carl, that was really useful.
It's useful to get everyone's kind of perspective. And that's part of the thing. You might go on a training course and someone might use just slightly the wrong phrase. I remember yonks ago, people talking about the purpose limitation principle about processing for specific legitimate and explicit purposes, and it doesn't say that. It says specified, and there's a massive difference between specific and specified. And I think it doesn't take much to get a word wrong, unintentionally, accidentally, whatever. So it's important that we kind of get clarification on some of these points. My cogs are obviously very obvious if Amy can see them turning. At least we've got cogs turning still. They are a bit rusty these days, but anyway.
No, not at all, Phil, not at all. But no, as everyone said in the chat, I do believe that's correct. It is acknowledged. I think that's a specific phrase.
Yeah,
used.
It is.
And it is.
But what does that mean?
Intention.
So that's where the guidance is going to come out into. Yeah, so what does that mean, just getting back? And you know, why 30 days when everything else in GPR is a month and things in the foyer are 20 workers? You know, it just, I can't really understand how they've thought, we're just chucking another time dimension to confuse everybody.
It's a bit awkward, isn't it? And sometimes I wonder if they just forget.
I think they're really informed. Nobody uses legitimate interests, you know, therefore let's, you know, introduce something new. You know, nobody understands it, let's introduce something new. We all do understand it. You know, we don't need those recognised legitimate interests, really. Yeah. We can justify them through an LIA process.
I wonder if it's going to lead to people going back into the rope roughing as Carl's doing and seeing if they can shift more towards legitimate interest. I mean, The point Carl raised about the ICO saying we're surprised legitimate interest isn't used more is absolutely crazy to me.
Well, it depends who they're working with. So if the ICO is working mostly with public authorities who can't really leverage legitimate interest very easily, then maybe they're seeing a warped perspective. Who knows?
Yeah, no, potentially. It may lead to more people re-looking, reassessing the lawful basis. But
yeah,
I find
but
that
I think
hard
he.
To- leave.
Yeah, I think you need to review. You definitely need to review Europa. I mean, if Europa's good, right, then I was talking about, asked a question earlier on about, can we talk about research and stuff like that? And so if you are, you know, undertaking processing activities for, you know, statistical research, historical archive purposes, all the things that's caught here, then you need to know, because you need to start thinking about how to change them. And if you're not, and you're doing things, I mean, recognized register of interest is quite narrowly defined, isn't it? You know, but if you are doing processing on the for national security or any other recognized register of interest, you need to find that and then go through and find the privacy information. And you've got to go through a process of changing. So I think it's one of the starting points for me, now we know where we're going with this, is I need to review my ROPA to find out if I'm doing anything that's changed. I need to review my cookie policy to find if I'm doing any cookies that need reclassifying or that I now don't need consent for. So I'm tidying up my consent management process.
I think that might be the biggest thing, as a first action, just because obviously, of course, as we all know, PECR obligations are much easier to identify gaps and non-compliances. And to me, it's easier to get all that stuff in hand first. Obviously, you're going to have to update your cookie banner in reflection of if you're going to change. Obviously, I mean, I guess you could strictly still ask for consent if you really wanted, but presumably quite a lot of people are going to move away from that in terms of the new cookies that don't need that consent. But that does require obviously quite a few steps in that regard. We've got to change the cookie banner. And I think we need to make it quite clear that things have changed in relation to the cookies that we're using as well. And the fact that you are now consenting to different kinds of cookies and what that may mean. Of course, with that means your cookie notice also has to apply an update. So some element of a cookie audit or some kind of website review of that kind of realm is probably required. And one of the main things that I'm saying to customers at the moment, because I think that is a big one, because, you know, I think what we've told from doing these cookie audits, Phil, is we've done a handful before, is that, you know, the cookies just tend to change quite a lot over time as well. I think unknowingly to organizations occasionally.
Well, the biggest weakness we have found doing cookie audits is that there's a lack of governance. So the cookie policy, to me, should be a policy about the use of cookies rather than the document, like the privacy notice, you know, the document explaining what cookies are there. And there's usually a whole level of governance missing. You know, nobody's approving the use of cookies, nobody's checking them, nobody's auditing. There's no approvals process for, you know, intrusive cookie use. That whole, so every time we've done a cookie audit, every time I've been involved with a cookie audit, we've found that whole piece of governance absent.
No, for sure. It was a very similar case scenario to me and Kate when we undertook ours as well. Very interesting. But I would say that's definitely something to focus on, is definitely give a big focus into the cookie work and the cookie, you know, specifically the banners. Again, because they are so easy to find on. And again, it's easier to branch the ICO's reach to those kind of things as opposed to investigating all these all these different things that they're receiving. I think I've seen something about an annual report that they did recently, and apparently it said that 12,412 personal data breaches were reported to the ICO in a year, and only 3% of those resulted in an investigation, which is a very, very minute number, isn't it? Which is something that just kind of popped into my head now as we were talking about it. That is a very small number, isn't it? In terms of what they're actually looking at, 3% resulted into an investigation, which probably makes sense as to why the right to complain has popped up, because presumably they're getting a lot of stuff that isn't worth their time, or maybe there's stuff flying under the radar. I'm not sure, but
yeah, I mean, the right to complain bit is all, I think it's quite significant, because you know, it's not so much that nobody's got a complaints management policy or that, you know, people have not had the right to complain in the past, but now the data controllers have got a legal obligation to, you know, respond as it's one of the rights. And you know, it might prompt the ICO wants to see how you are, you know, if it calls in, somebody complains, you deal with it, you know, they complain to the ICO, they call in the complaint, they have a look at it. You know, there's a chance that you might then be found to be in breach of the new aspects of the GDPR, the complaint handling process, as well as what it was that people were complaining about in the first place. And I just don't think they're going to be resourced up for this, to be fair. You know, I think they're going to still be, unless it's patently obvious the data controller is absolutely out to sea, I think that the assumption will be that what the data controller says and can demonstrate is accurate and factual. And, you know, they'll side with the controller, I think, in many cases.
Yeah, I think I agree. It also stresses the benefit on justifying all internal decisions. I'm sure it's something that across the board is largely being done, but you do occasionally see gaps there where certain decisions, whether it's in mind of a business or in mind of the process, and aren't documented as well as they should to present a decision that's been made. And I think the key, especially obviously now with the new reporting, which may or may not happen, in terms of what the ICO says, I think it's even more crucial is that with the complaints policy and procedures working around it, it's having a very, very, very strong log of that very clearly demonstrates how you are complying with the legislation, because it's very easy for them to turn around and say otherwise. And if you've got no way to prove it, then the ICO has got nothing to go off, effectively.
It's tricky. They've got to do a thorough investigation to get under the skin of it. I mean, I did all the complaint last Friday and a little bit over the weekend and Monday. Somebody had complained about the misuse of their passport, complained to the ICO. The ICO wrote to the data controller and said, you know, what's going on here? They went back and said, you know, we haven't misused it at all, et cetera, et cetera. ICO went back to the data subject went back to the ICO. ICO eventually wrote to the controller saying, you know, you don't seem to have addressed the complaint satisfactory. We suggest you write back to explain what happened to the data subject. But what they're not saying is, oh, hang on, this is a bit fishy, we're going to come and have a look at this. So basically saying, yeah, you know, sort it out amongst yourselves.
I've never seen them do that from my experience, and actually attempt to get involved in any kind of way in any of my dealings with personal data breaches, to be honest. If I've ever had to have anything that involves me working with the ICO, it's always like, have you spoke to them first? The response is usually yes, we have. And then it's, you know, I think you speak to them again and clarify some points around X, Y, and Z. I've never really seen it go any further than that, unless I'm misremembering something.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we obviously have to do, and we can do that again, we can start to do that now, is retraining people about anything that affects them. So, you know, presumably everyone is already working to a reasonable proportion of certs because courts have kind of set a precedent. Now that's been codified and backdated and is there now. But, you know, what, again, I think I'm looking forward to the guidance. What does that actually mean? You know, if we're a small organization, you know, and the GDPR permits us to take into consideration budget when we're looking at security measures, it says, you know, it's got cost is one of those factors you can consider. Mm. So, you know, is it also going to be the case that, you know, as a small organization, you know, with fewer resources, we don't have to commit a huge search, or are they going to be saying, no, we expect you now to invest in search systems so that you can be more efficient? You know, it'd be interesting to see
It has an effect on an individual's right, doesn't it? Effectively, the size of a business and the budget it has for data protection, that could then have an impact on what they can receive in terms of actually exercising their right, which is a strange one, because obviously what I was hoping with to do is it would give us something a little bit more in the realms of what is a reasonable and proportionate search. And hopefully, I'm not super optimistic, but hopefully the ICO will come out with something that does help set out those parameters a little bit better, because I still have loads of customers unsure on what that means, and it's not as clear cut as, oh, it's these factors. It's very dependent to the business, and I'm kind of always in the camp of, even if it's going to take you a little bit more time, if you can, I'd probably try and run it all if possible. Obviously, I understand in some circumstances that just isn't feasible. I just think it's easier to try and appease it as best as you can. I know a lot of people take the mindset that, you know, these people are making the SAR just to be bothersome, but I think it is easier, and maybe in the long run, but I think that's just my opinion, and trying to run whatever you can. But I'm not sure. It is one of those things. I'm same camp as you. I'm very much looking forward to the guidance that we're hopefully going to get from the ICO. Oh no. Bill, you might have frozen on my screen. Or maybe I've frozen. Lost it. Oh, it's just Phil. Oh, great. So he's left me to dry. I see how it is. that camera's off. Maybe we're back in business. I'm not sure. Because if not, I'll have to do the last 15 minutes like a little bit of stand up or something, maybe. That's what I thought. I thought I was just in deep thought.
My team just shut down.
I was like, oh, I must be saying something along the right lines, because Phil's just like really, really zoned in on what I'm saying.
I just all of a sudden, boom, the screen went blank.
Oh, well, you worried me for a second there. I thought I'd have to just chat for 15 minutes there. Shah was saying that I should sing a song.
Well, we've got the song to sing, haven't we? I still want to do that. I still want us to do.
We're pretty
recording
on board,
to the tune of New York, New York, GDPR, which we've got the lyrics for. Yeah.
You're definitely very prideful for it, Phil. I'm sure we can do something about it. I'm sure the people are more than eager.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll organise it. So we were talking before I got thrown out of here by the bouncer about the SARS. I'm sure that the ICO is going to, you know, that's what the guidance will say. You know, these are the things to consider that would make that search reasonable, proportionate in the circumstances. But it can't be that prescriptive because there's so many variations, aren't there?
No, absolutely. It is going to be an awkward one for sure. I feel similarly with the right to complain as you do. I think we're pale around that is the biggest thing in terms of what it is. I do think people are more well equipped for it though than I think initially presumed. I think the biggest changes are probably going to be around of putting that to face initially with the privacy information that you're going to have to obviously update in light with that. I don't know at the moment in how you like introduce that in the most productive way. I think initially I was thinking of having it as its own sort of section, similarly, like just sort of above the rights complaint to the ICO, but and then eventually just like reincorporating it with the rest of the rights as they're usually just like easily broken down. But I think it's something that maybe should have more of an effort of bringing to face initially, just because it's something that people aren't going to be aware of from the outset in terms of members of the public.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure how much we are genned up, to be perfectly honest, on research, because not many of our customers do proper research as defined and regulated by this. But I think we probably ought to, because it was one of the first questions asked, could we have a quick look on research? So if you're comfortable talking about it, let's just kind of our superficial overview, really, of doer changes. To me, it kind of does a few things. You know, it redefines a little bit in the definitions, what it considers to be research. Again, people here probably know more about this than I do, because they're probably focused on it more, because it might affect them more. And there's obviously adjustments to the lawful purpose limitation principle.
Yes.
So I'm trying to get it out there. So that it's kind of a bit easier to say, well, this is a compatible purpose. And then changes to the requirement for consent. I think the key thing is, what are we doing that is caught by this, notion of research, historical archiving, etc. Because it seems quite specific, and I wouldn't have thought many organisations would be doing something that's caught by the research provisions. But might be wrong. Oh, clinical research, yeah. Someone's asked about, yeah.
I would definitely be open to be more educated on that side of things, to be fair. Again, I feel like it's something that is very, very advanced level for me as it stands, whilst it doesn't like seem to affect our immediate customer base. But it's definitely something I would like to know much more about. So maybe it's something we do a little bit of research.
Yeah, into. We'll do. I mean, it's been described. Maybe we could issue a paper. I mean, it's been described in the kind of preliminaries to the doer bill that we're trying to make the UK a more attractive place in which to do research. So I kind of characterize it as if kind of watered down certain bits of the GDPR or clarified that in these circumstances and you've got a bit more latitude to go off and do reuse data. I mean, there's also the data use parts of the doer which we haven't really talked about because they don't affect most privacy practitioners. Again, that might be something that from a research point of view, we ought to be looking at that as well, rather than just the things that affect the obvious parts of the GDPR.
Well, Keely's saying that she can't find much about it online in terms of infection. So maybe it gives us I'll do some work on it.
Yeah. I'll do some work on it and I'll push it out. I'll do some work on it. Sorry we can't answer the question now, Keely. Yeah, no,
apologies.
Yeah, leave it with us. We'll do some work on kind of impact on research organisations and we will push it out somehow.
That'd be amazing. Thank you so much.
No, no, you're welcome. You know, like, we like doing this kind of stuff. It's all good.
Yeah, this is always your favorite time of the week, isn't it, Phil? You love your little research pieces and
yeah,
stuff
yeah,
like
it's good.
That.
It's good. Yeah. So yeah, I've lost a thread now, having bailed out. But training is again, we need to update our standard operating procedures. Mm-hmm. You know, around, for instance, the SARS and one for complaint handling, and that means we've got to train everybody. You know, if we're introducing new protocols in working, you know, personal protection or whatever it is, you know, the data protection policy has to change. The relevant SOPs have got to change. You know, so it's quite a bit of paperwork to change, and then obviously that needs training into the org.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know how much of it, like, in terms of, like, the smaller changes, like the definitions and stuff like that, is obviously going to be beneficial to training per se. Of course, to maybe likely be reflected in your policy and procedural work, but I do think the complaints, and specifically for, like, the charity sector, things like the soft opt-in, when organisations choose to apply, if they do, is obviously the key is on the big changes, I think, because the right to complain is likely going to have an effect on everyone within the business in terms of, as much as it's probably got a direct channel for complaints within the business, I can't believe, even for normal complaints, that happens very often, that it goes to the channel that it should. I presume everybody's probably getting complaints about all sorts of matters, and it's how they have to handle that, I suppose.
Yeah. I'll tell you another quite big one, I think, again, affects possibly a lot of organisations, is the changes to data protection by design and by default. So Section 81 of DUA changes the Article 25 of the GDPR, the data protection by design by default piece. And it's really only affecting organisations providing information society services, i.e. you know, various web applications and games and things like that. You know, there are limitations to what, and it's a defined term, information society service. But if you're providing information society services which might be accessed by children, but I think what it's doing is it's saying you've got to basically consider the age-appropriate design code of practice in order to portray privacy by design. So again, I think there's a lot of organizations, we're working with some football club websites will be accessed by under 18s undoubtedly. You know, so now what the changes here are saying is, you know, okay, you know, accountability, show us what you've done to consider the impact on young people and how you've accommodated those changes in your information society services.
Yeah, and I mean, it's definitely going to be more impactful on certain sectors than others, as you say, Phil. I think it's something that, again, that should largely already be being done. I think if you could, it's one of those things, if you reasonably
expect.
Yeah,
but it won't be being done. I don't think so. No, because the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice, the Children's Code, is a statutory code of practice, but it's not the law. Well, now my reading is it's the law. Yeah. You know, so statutory code of practice can be taken into account by the courts when they're considering, you know, the cases. But this, I think, notches it up a bit. And I don't know anybody. We've worked with quite a lot of organizations. I can't think of any organization we've worked with that has stepped through the children's code and has made sure that they've got privacy relevant information for all the various categories, you know, 0 to 5, 6 to 9, whatever it is in the children's code. I've not seen anything that somebody can demonstrate that they've been through that.
Yeah, I've seen people undertake the assessment, the children's code assessment on the ICO website. I've done some work with customers on that before. But it's mainly like leaning off of the stuff in the DPI. I don't think there's much of an appetite to like change it that heavily when they've already sort of like teetered towards that side. They've done the DPIA, and I think it's just like, oh, you know, the DPIA kind of covers these things. But there's good examples of like solid sets with the age appropriate code of conduct, isn't there? Like I know you really like Lego's privacy notice, isn't it?
Lego's is pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good. I like the fact it's creative.
Yeah, it's something to consider across the board, isn't it? If you're trying to do these kind of things, I think it probably works easier for an organisation like Lego. But I do think where you draw the distinction between what is reasonably accessed by under 18s now, because I think that scope is a bit broader to what it would have been like maybe 20.
Well, that's
20
one of the principal so. The principal things I've always said is that, well, how do you know it's not being accessed by under 18s? Have you done any focus groups? You know, have you got anything? I mean, the thing is, I mean, you know, what Mira is saying is you know, really, really relevant. You know, the Online Safety Act and this, you know, and other changes are actually seeming to come together. Actually, there seems potentially be some kind of thought process, a strategy behind it. Potentially.
Maybe. Who knows?
I mean, we're actually in danger of maybe getting a few things right. I mean, crikey, you know, it would potentially be
nice.
A lot of stuff maybe moving in the same direction. Mm. You know, so yeah, it's quite exciting times, I think, in this field of work.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think it's one of the best times to be in the space as things are changing. It is really nice, and I think a lot of the changes they've done are really quite positive. I think they've made amendments for things that maybe already probably should have been in place. But I think they've done a good enough. I think they've done a good enough job in covering specific gaps where I think they should have been. And then maybe have more updates and legislation to come in the future that covers even more gaps and issues that we've
I'm still gutted they're not done three things: custodial sentences, mandatory audits. Public register.
How would a mandatory audit look, as in all organizations are obliged to undertake an audit every year?
All organizations undertaking, you know, maybe even just high-risk processing, have to have, you know, some kind of, you know, audit certification piece. How are you checking that people are complying with it? A registration process would be a good start, you know, having to put your ROPAs into the public domain so people can check what you're meant to be doing. And maybe an annual refresh. Maybe you don't need an audit at all. Maybe that's something that would achieve the same purpose, which is ensuring that people are stepping through. Exactly, Janice. NHS got the DSPT every year. So, you know, it could be done, but it's just, I think, a big shortcoming.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a very fair point, I suppose.
Oh, that's a good point, David. That is a good point. Yes, we might be able to...
Very well, mate.
I have not thought of that. No, of course, I haven't thought of that. But anyway, on that note, it's now 28 minutes past, Kane, and I know we probably haven't spoken about the Do It as much as we probably promised we would do. There was quite a bit of news to cover off, and we've gone at a much slower pace this time. We'll take away that request about two things, I think: research and the data use parts of the data use and access bill. Public sharing, all that kind of stuff. We'll take that away as an action, and we'll do some thinking and some work on it, and we'll come back with something. I don't know when the next podcast is. It's a shame that we don't. To me, it's a shame we don't do them weekly anymore. But
I suppose we will. We shall see. I think at the moment it's been very free flowing in terms of how we're running them. Running them more based off obviously needs. I think the Do one was more based on availability as well, but. I think if there's appetite for it, I don't see why not, Phil. Also, just to reiterate again on the side of what Miles mentioned in terms of just expecting to hear from him in relation to our in-person Doer event, it will, you know, likely be much more detailed than these sessions. So if you guys are interested in something like that, or you came to our first in-person session that we did in relation to dish repair claims and SARS. If you could fill out the form, as I say, it should only take 30 seconds or so. We can gauge a little bit of interest for the event, and then hopefully put together a good show for those who want to come down.
Very good. Well, I'd like to thank you, Kane, for your expert opinion and your contributions and holding the fort whilst I went to make a cup of tea. I didn't really do that, by the way. And everybody else for joining and your contributions and unmuting, and you know, it's what makes it fun is interaction. That's absolutely what makes it good. So on that note, thank you very much, everyone, and have a cracking weekend, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Yep. See you soon, guys. Thank you.